You're listening to Advancing Quit Services, a podcast about tobacco cessation from Optum, where we discuss barriers to quitting tobacco and strategies for overcoming them with experts at the forefront of tobacco research. I'm your host, Brandon Benzin. I'm a business strategy manager at Optum. Today's topic is tobacco priority populations. We'll cover who these populations are, why they exist, and the barriers they face, followed by a discussion about what can be done to overcome those barriers. My guests today are Etta Short, public health leader and senior product manager for clinical development at Optum, and Dr. Kelly Carpenter, principal scientist at the Optum Center for Wellbeing Research. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Let's start with the basics. What is a priority population in the context of tobacco use, and why do priority populations exist in the first place? Etta, I'd like to start with you.
Thanks for giving us the opportunity to talk on this topic today. For me, tobacco is a social justice issue, and thinking about this gives me motivation every day for my work. Priority populations are those smoking at higher rates than the general U.S. population. The tobacco use rate in the U.S. has been steadily declining. Consider this. The tobacco use rate was more than 40% when it was peaking in the 1960s. And today, just under 14% of U.S. adults are smoking. But that's actually not the full story, because there are populations in the U.S. that are smoking at higher rates, some 35% or more. And, you know, when you think about these populations, most of these are underserved. They are disadvantaged populations. So when you're looking at, you know, where to put tobacco control money and money in tobacco cessation, it makes sense to put it there where you can help these vulnerable populations to work at lowering their quit rate, at increasing the quality of their lives. And overall, what we'll be doing is lowering the overall tobacco use rate in the U.S. This, you know, lowers medical cost. This also lowers cost and increases productivity for businesses.
Yeah, and even in addition to those groups that smoke at higher rates, there are also groups that, while they may not smoke at higher rates, they really carry a disproportionate burden with regard to ability to quit, and they suffer higher rates of tobacco-related illnesses and death.
Can you give me a few examples of populations that have been disproportionately affected by tobacco?
Yeah, so tobacco-related disparities affect a lot of different groups based on a variety of factors, such as race and ethnicity, socioeconomic factors, minority groups like sexual and gender minorities. For example, African Americans smoke at rates not too different from other groups, but we see a disproportionate percentage of tobacco-related illness and death. Tobacco use is a major contributor to the three leading causes of death among African Americans: heart disease, cancer, and stroke. Another example is people with behavioral health conditions. They smoke at far higher rates than those without these conditions. In fact, about half of all cigarettes smoked in the U.S. are smoked by people with behavioral health conditions. And among people with what we call serious mental illness, like schizophrenia, they lose 20 to 30 years of their lives related to tobacco-related illness. Also, people with low income tend to smoke at higher rates than others.
Listening to Kelly, you can see that there's just not one way to characterize these vulnerable populations. You know, she mentioned a few different groups. You know, on one hand, there are the racial and ethnic groups. I can add to the list Native American and Alaska Natives, which have really high smoking rates, maybe some of the highest in the U.S., the LGBTQ community, as Kelly mentioned. But you also can look at groups like pregnant women. They have a lower smoking rate, but they're included because the risk to the mother is so high, and also the risk to the pregnancy. And then after the child is born, it's the secondhand smoke issues that also are important to consider. You can also look at geographical disparities as well. We see much higher tobacco use rates in the rural communities or in the Midwest and the Southeast.
What kind of barriers do priority populations face that other individuals don't have to overcome?
So one of the barriers that span most of the groups is systematic discrimination. And then one of the other barriers that you see across all groups is increased stress.
Yeah, other things are factors like inadequate access to healthcare, lower health literacy, and being a member of a community where tobacco use is common and the norms around tobacco use are different than in other groups.
You know, one other thing I could add is that these populations are also specifically targeted by tobacco companies. In the past, free cigarettes were given away in housing projects, even to the kids. People were issued coupons for cheaper cigarettes. What's really common today is advertising, you know, the ads that people see both in print and at the point of sale where people are buying tobacco products. I was in a store recently where in an area where there's a high tobacco use, and it was actually a low-income community. I was in a grocery store and I saw at the register at the back of the counter was just blanketed with tobacco products and tobacco ads. And I compare that to my own grocery store where the cigarettes are locked away in a cabinet, kind of almost even out of sight. So it really brought to light how the environment really does normalize cigarette use in some places and in some neighborhoods.
Okay, so we've discussed who priority populations are and why they exist, the problems that they might experience, and the root causes of these problems. But it's not all bad news, right? There must be some strategies Quitlines can use to address these barriers.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that we can do to meet the needs of this population. And one of the big things we can do is, you know, training the quit coaches, giving them training on specific tobacco-related and culture-related issues that impact their use of tobacco and quitting tobacco. We can also train coaches or hire folks who have the facilitation skills to meet participants where they're at so they can really listen and reflect the true meaning and feelings and work to build trust. We can make sure we bring in cultural sensitivity training and awareness, and so coaches are aware of their biases and work to be judgment-free and assumption-free. And then a really big thing we can do is build in health equity checks with our interventions, both the interventions that coaches do in their interactions, but also look at any materials or digital materials, looking at content and visual, and make sure that we are looking at all populations and speaking to all populations. And to do this, you have to learn about the populations that you're working with so you can understand the barriers, understand the strengths they're bringing to change, and understand the strategies that are going to work the most and make the biggest difference.
I would say that tobacco quit lines were designed as a way to reduce barriers. I mean, if you look at how they're structured, they're phone-based, so they're convenient. You don't need childcare to take a quit line call. They're free. They offer free nicotine replacement in the majority of cases. Of course, there's still room to improve our reach and effectiveness, but I do think that quit lines are just in and of themselves a way to reduce barriers.
So now to focus on Optum. Does Optum serve priority populations and address the systemic barriers they face?
For tobacco quit lines, really their reason for being is to reduce these barriers. And we also have some specialized tailored programs. For example, our behavioral health program, which we piloted in 2017, is now offered in 12 states. And this program offers increased nicotine replacement, additional coaching calls with specially trained coaches. The extra calls allow participants time to build skills and access support. There's a big emphasis on stress in this program, which is the most common reason cited for relapse to smoking. We also facilitate communication between the participant and their healthcare provider by sending a letter to the provider, letting them know that their patient is trying to quit smoking and offering tips for supporting them.
Another example is our work with Native Americans. And one of the crucial elements of working with these folks is to be sure that you have Native American partners that you're working with so you can build trust and build the bridges. When we created our first program with the Native Americans, we realized that we needed to spend time just having conversations and learning about what the issues are and what was most meaningful. And as someone who was working on the program, it actually struck me in an emotional way. And as we started developing how we were going to deliver it, in addition to the components of the program, we realized that training of coaches, our partners had to be part of it. they had to present the majority of the training because they had to share their stories from their mouth to talk about how, you know, systematic racism affected them, how the laws that kind of were separating families and trying to, you know, destroy the culture, the impact that it had. Also, the issue of sacred tobacco. And that's such an important piece of the reason why commercial tobacco, you know, and sacred tobacco has to be separated. And having the coaches understand what that meant really made a big difference. And what we also discovered is every time we brought in a new state to the program, we had to bring in partners so the coaches can learn about the differences between the tribes, not only regionally, you know, between the states, but even within states, there are tribal differences. One of the things that kind of hit me in terms of bringing ownership to the American Indian population, I was listening to a webinar that one of our partners was delivering, and she described it as our quit line. And that just brought the biggest smile to my face because I felt like we really bridged that gap and built that trust where our partners felt the ownership of the program.
Yeah, and not only can we use tailored coaching programs like the two that we just described, but we've also been trying digital modalities to help address the needs of our priority population. In our Project Free study, which was a 4-year study funded by the American Cancer Society and conducted with the North Carolina Quit Line, we looked at a video-based intervention that had been specifically developed to help African Americans quit smoking. The video had sections on the history of African Americans and the tobacco industry, menthol flavoring, which has been heavily marketed to African Americans and which makes it harder to quit, among other topics. And in this study, we had more than 1,000 African American smokers randomized to either get our regular Quitline program alone or the regular program plus access to this tailored video or a standard control video. And we found that those who were randomized to the video that had been tailored for African Americans, they were more likely to quit smoking. So these digital methods of tailoring can be more flexibly offered. They don't require training or supervision of coaches or more time on the phone. So they can be expensive to develop, but once they're developed, they can be disseminated more easily and with less cost, and they can be sent to the correct person at the correct time. And now we're working on being able to offer this video intervention to all of our African-American Quitline participants.
Thank you, Etta and Dr. Carpenter. You both clearly have a wealth of knowledge and tons of experience in driving outcomes for priority populations. As we close out with our final question, if you had to boil it down to one recommendation for helping priority populations successfully quit, what would that recommendation be?
So while considering developing interventions for vulnerable populations, it's really important to keep in mind the common challenges that they have, including systematic racism and tobacco companies that target these populations, as well as the social determinants of health. And what I mean by that are things in your community that can set you up for success or failure, like lack of access to medical care, lack of access to transportation, childcare, and all those kinds of things.
Yeah. And, you know, at the same time, it's essential to also consider that one size does not fit all. We want to tease out those specific barriers and characteristics of the population that need to be addressed for promotion of the services, for engagement in the services, and also what, you know, the strategies that will facilitate cessation with the participants. You know, that involves bringing in people outside that know about the population, you know, not relying on our internal expertise, but going to external experts as well. And we also have to keep in mind that each participant has specific challenges and strengths. And while we can keep, you know, population generalizations in mind, we need to serve the individual. So we like to say that we treat populations one person at a time.
Thank you, Etta and Dr. Carpenter, for joining me today.
Brandon, thanks.
Thank you so much for having us.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to the Priority Populations podcast from Optum. For more on serving priority populations, including a recording of our recent Priority Populations webinar, please visit optum.com/quitservices. Stay safe and healthy out there.